I'll recognize Mr. Downey for a motion. We're going to call the Customer Service and Operations Committee to order. Mr. Downey has a motion. Just before he began.
On behalf of the Audit Committee, Chair, I move that the Audits and Investigations Committee certify, to the best of each member's knowledge and with no individual member dissenting, that at the executive session of that committee on April 10th and at the just concluded executive session of the committee on July 10th, only such matters as are authorized for discussion in executive session under Board Bylaws Article 10, and only those matters identified in the notice by which the executive sessions were convened, were heard, discussed, or considered by the committee. Is there a second?
Second, Mr. Dyke.
Yep.
Discussion?
Any discussion? If not, all in favor?
Oh, I'm sorry.
He wasn't there. Yeah.
I'll allow you to do so then. Okay. It doesn't say he can't second.
You were there in spirit.
Go right ahead. Thank you very much. No discussion?
No discussion.
All those in favor?
Aye.
And opposed? The next item is our safety contact, and Mr. Downey. Good morning.
Thank you, and good morning, Chair Hutchins, members of the board. Just as a reminder, in the event the fire alarm goes off, we ask that you exit the doors to my right or left, cross Fifth Street, using the crosswalks, please, and assemble on the sidewalk in the corner of the National Building Museum as the fence is up. Our safety contact for the day deals with safety tips for preventing the deaths of children in hot cars. Basically, the message is to never leave children alone in a vehicle to run even a short errand. More than three dozen children die of hypothermia in cars annually in the United States, and since 1998, more than 500 children have died in hot cars. Heat stroke can happen when a temperature is as low as 57 degrees, and car interiors can reach well over 110 degrees, even when the outside temperature is in the 60s. Here are some tips from safety advocates on avoiding accidental deaths in hot cars. Never leave children alone in a vehicle to run even a short errand. Use drive-through windows at banks, dry cleaners, and restaurants when possible. Use a debit or credit card to pay for gas at the pump. Put a purse, cell phone, or other item you will need in the back seat of your car. This will ensure that you check the back seat before leaving the vehicle. Make a habit of opening the back door of your car and checking the back seat whenever you exit it. Keep a stuffed animal or toy in your child's unoccupied car seat. Put that item in the front seat when you place the child in the seat as a reminder that the child is in the back seat of the car. If a child is missing, immediately check the car, including the trunk. If you see a child alone in any vehicle for more than a few minutes, get the child out and call 911. And these tips are offered by the Connecticut State Police and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. And that concludes our safety contact. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dowdy. Before I set the agenda and I ask for approval, is there a motion for approval?
Mm-hmm.
And a second?
Second.
Any discussion or question? It's appropriate today. All those in favor? And opposed? And next, the approval of the minutes of the March 13th Safety and Customer and Operations Committee. Is there a motion? Motion by Mr. Downs and a second. Second by Mr. Dyke. A discussion? None. All those in favor?
Aye.
And those opposed? Today's agenda has one action item, and we have in that item is going to be presented by Mr. Rickwer. And this is seeking approval of to hold the public hearings on our bus service adjustments. These have become, I think, the good news piece that we all get a chance to talk about. And these adjustments are going into effect in December 24th, between 2014 and August of 2015. And we will then, following that item, we'll receive an update from Dr. Trish Hendren, Director of the Office of Performance, about rail service standards. And those they will focus on our passenger car standards that were approved by the board and where we are in terms of meeting those targets. And the last item is the new initiative from our customer care that will be presented by Deputy General Manager Lynn Barasak. And we can begin the presentation with Mr. Rickwer.
Good morning.
Okay.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
Last month, there was a discussion at the committee meeting regarding bus ridership and its continual increase, and I'd just say that our preliminary numbers for FY14 show about a 2.8 million more riders than we had in the previous year. So, you know, things are going in the right direction, and we believe that the actions that we bring forward today are just a small part of the actions that we take during the year to increase ridership and make the service more effective. We're here today to obtain the committee and the Board of Directors approval to hold public hearings for bus service changes and a fare reduction tariff. I just want to note that in Virginia, we've studied the Annandale service, and the 29N is currently an express service. We think it'll be more effective if it's turned into a local, so usually tariff changes are upward. This one's a downward recommendation that we'll be exploring through the public hearing process. If you think you've seen this presentation before, you have. This is about third or fourth year that we brought forward, but it has shown results, and as this page shows, that when we go in and adjust a route based on the public hearing and the comments that we receive, we've seen about a 9.6% increase in ridership on these routes and an improvement on on-time performance of about 5.3%. So we think it's a good process. So how do we get here? We have, as you know, bus has board criteria that we review on a regular basis, looking at all of the regional and non-regional routes. We discuss with our customers and jurisdictional staff. We have over 100 meetings a year. Our planning staff is out in the community talking about specific changes, concerns, and comments by the public. We develop recommendations for service changes, which are included in your packet today. And following our reviews with the jurisdictions, we've brought them to this committee recommending that we think that we're ready to have public hearings to get further public input on this, and then we would come back to you in November with a final report from the public hearing and final recommendations for service adjustments. With, as you said, Ms. Hudgens, the implementation could be anywhere between December and next summer of 2015. Public hearings are proposed for each jurisdiction. Again, we'll gather customer feedback from the menu of options and develop a final list of recommendations. And again, we anticipate that we will see improved reliability, we'll see improved service to the customer, fewer complaints, increased ridership, and hopefully fare box recovery. We want to improve on-time performance, and as the region continues to adjust, we think that these service adjustments will be effective, and they can be done without any increase in cost or increase in subsidy. So with that, I would recommend to the committee, or our recommendation is that you approve the setting up of public hearings that would take place. I think the Secretary's office is looking at the end of September to early October for public hearings to discuss the service changes and the tariff reduction. And any questions, I'll be happy to try to answer those.
I noticed that two corridors that were under public hearing last year are back again, with a note that public hearings for service changes proposed in fall 2013 are now out of date, right, on the 96-97 and the 234 on the E's.
Right.
I think if we're going to go to public hearing, it needs to have some further explanation of why the public hearings and the decision process last year, okay, didn't work out, mm-hmm, and we have a new set of public hearings. It is the first time that I can remember about having back-to-back public hearings on route changes on the same route.
Well, we can do that during the public hearing and explain why we're back. Again, there are changes that we think could make things better. And there wasn't total approval acceptance from the jurisdiction in regards to those. So we've talked to jurisdictions again. We believe that it's time to bring these back. And council indicates that if you don't implement the service changes prior to the next set of public hearings, that you need to put it back on the list. So that's why it's here.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Jack, thanks. Are we going to be looking at any of the, excuse me, poorly performing routes during this version of public hearings?
One more time, sir.
Are we going to look at any of our poorly...
Yes.
operating farebox recovery.
What we're doing is some of these recommendations are looking at the poor performers, trying to either make them better, consolidate services, which eliminate some trips or some routes, but generally it doesn't take service away from the customer, it just makes the service more efficient.
Thank you.
Just following up on that, could you recirculate to us the performance report on the routes? In prior years, we've seen that before.
We do that on the database, and we'll get back to you. I'm not sure when we do the next one, but we'll
whenever before the hearings.
We will. Okay.
And with respect to the hearings, you're saying they will be after the summer?
End of September, early
October. Mm-hmm. And we'll work to have them at accessible locations?
Yes, we will. Mm-hmm. We work the Secretary's office with that.
With that, no other questions. I just think that it's important that we emphasize this has really been an initiative outside of the budget process that really does get to the points of great benefit to Boulder, the opportunity to look at these and no additional costs in terms of within our programming and improve service to the customers. So I think it's really important. Is there a motion?
Before we vote, could I just ask another question, a procedural question? Yesterday, in conversation with my staff, we identified something that's not here that hadn't been looked at before in her memory by WMATA staff. Is there the opportunity between now and the board meeting for that conversation to occur? And if people agree it's a good idea, it could be added.
If the board agrees to an amendment at the time of the board meeting, if there's something that should be added to the list, I don't. So in the next
2 weeks, right? Yeah.
Right. That's, so if that is raised either now or at that time, we can add it to the recommendation.
I want her to have the conversation. I'm not sure it's worth saying it out loud today. I think
Mr. Hamry, who's here, will check with your staff and talk about.
That'd be. I just want to make sure that exactly that is absolutely the requirement. Thank you.
He watches this very carefully.
It's a good time to get in. Is there a motion to approve resolution as noted? Moved by Mr. Bolger. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Mr. Downey. All those in favor?
Aye.
And opposed? Thank you very much, Mr. Rickler.
Thank you.
The next item before us is the RIF service from Dr. Hendren. Thank you very much.
So thank you, Chair Hudgens. So this morning's presentation provides an update on the three rail service standards adopted by the board in 2013 and 2012. In addition, we'll provide a customer perspective on the passengers per car crowding standard. So as you know, the board created new bylaws in 2011 that reinforced the board's role as a policy oversight entity. To fulfill this policy role, the board adopted the first ever rail service standards. The first standard, hours of service, lets our customers know when Metro will be open for business. The second standard, headway, sets the scheduled amount of time between trains. And third, passengers per car, sets a minimum and maximum crowding tolerance for a rail car. As the standards were adopted for weekday rush and non-rush, we began tracking standard adherence in the quarterly vital signs report. So how well has Metro been adhering to the three rail service standards? Metro is adhering to the hours of service standard, opening service Monday through Friday at 5 a.m. and beginning each Saturday and Sunday at 7 a.m. We have an ending service at 12 a.m. Sunday through Thursday and continuing Friday and Saturday service until 3 a.m. All exceptions are explained in the vital signs report, such as a 5 a.m. opening on Sunday, October 27th, last year, for the Marine Corps Marathon, or us staying open late to make sure our NCAA basketball fans can get home. Metro has also been adhering to the headway standard by scheduling service according to the board-adopted time between trains for weekday rush and non-rush. Again, exceptions are noted in the vital signs report, such as reduced frequency given snowy conditions on February 13th or evening track work that is necessary for system rebuilding. So that brings us to the third criteria, which we have some mixed results. As members of the jurisdictional coordinating committee have noted, our passenger per car results have fallen below our minimum threshold of 80 passengers per car. So as you see on the slide where the arrow is pointing, in February 2014, our traffic checkers observed trains over 2 p.m. rush periods and found an average passengers per car of 71. So what I want to do is spend the next couple of slides going into what these passengers per car numbers mean from the customer perspective. So first, what are our customers telling us? So Metro customers are telling us that our trains are crowded. So crowded, in fact, that they can't get on board the trains. The recent survey as part of the Regional Transportation Priorities Plan found that 2 out of 3 people identified transit crowding as a top regional concern. So during the hearings last spring, several of the board members here today heard directly from the customers about how crowded their trains were. So in fact, I would imagine every person in this room has experienced a crowded train. So why are our passengers per car numbers telling a different story? So let's answer the question that might be on everyone's mind. Are the passengers per car numbers correct? So the answer is a resounding yes. The staff responsible for counting the number of people in each car have been specially trained, and this is also the industry standard method of collecting this information. So if the data is correct, having traffic checkers is industry standard, why are our passenger per car numbers lower than what our customers are telling us? So to answer this, let's go back to L'Enfant Station on February 3rd of this year. So what this graph will do is it'll represent what happened at L'Enfant Station from 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. So to orient you on this graph, across the bottom is time. So 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. If we can go back. So 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. I'll wait till this goes back. All right, there we go. So a lot of information, as you can see, is going to come in here. So just to orient you first, so this is February 3rd at L'Enfant, 5 to 6 p.m., so time is across the bottom. On the vertical axis, you see passengers per car. And this green area in the middle, this kind of highlighted green area, demonstrates our board standards. The red line at the bottom is our minimum standard at 80 passengers per car, and the upper line is 120, which is our maximum tolerance for crowding. And the line in the middle, this green line, is kind of the optimal number, 100 passengers per car. So to remind everyone, in general, there are about 65 seats on our trains. So if you're at this optimal level at 100 passengers per car, we need to remember there are no seats on the train. And there are people standing, and as we know, those people are standing most likely near the doors. So just to have that picture in your mind. So now that we see this graph, let's bring in the trains. So each grouping of white vertical bars here represents a train. Each vertical bar represents one car. So we see that 14 trains arrive between 5 and 6 p.m. And the passengers per car for this hour was 68, which is the average value across these 14 trains. And again, that value is below our standard. But when you start to look at those individual white bars, which is those individual cars, you begin to see why customers are stating they're facing crowded conditions. So let's just zoom in closer on three trains. So let's look at the 512, the 515, and the 518 train. So if you look at these trains, you start to begin to see why people are saying that they're experiencing crowded trains. In fact, if you look at the 512 and the 515 train, 75% of the people on those two trains were in crowded cars. If you look at individual cars, you can see that there's this one car here with 126 passengers on it. But then you'll also see the 518 train, there's 4 people on that last car. So that begins to show you this uneven distribution that we have of passengers if we look at each car. What we also see is in the middle of our trains is kind of where most of our crowding typically occurs. So that is in part due to how our system is, our stations are designed. So again, we're at L'Enfant. The escalator from the orange and blue line feeds into this platform in the middle. So that will kind of force, or towards that, the front part of the train. So that will lead to crowding at that part of our train. The uneven distribution of passengers across cars within a train also illustrates the preferences of our customers who want to ride on a particular car. So for me, when I pick up my daughters at the end of the day, I make sure that I'm on car number 4. Because when the door is open, I can get on that up escalator and make sure I don't get that dreaded daycare penalty. So a lot of passengers know which car that they want to get on. So when you look at passengers per car, per train, it really demonstrates how this uneven distribution is resulting in the crowded conditions that we're hearing from our customers. So what is Metro doing in order to address these crowded conditions? First, we're managing train spacing through on-time terminal dispatching and keeping even headways between trains. So just last night on my way home, the operator announced the train was going to be holding for a schedule adjustment. Those are key steps we take to make sure we have this even distribution between our trains and we keep crowding to a minimum. We're also informing our customers when the next train will arrive. So if a very crowded train pulls up, the customer has the choice to wait a few minutes for the next train. And these next train displays also tell the customer if it's an 8-car or 6-car train to encourage additional spreading across the platform. So finally, we broadcast announcements in our stations, and our operators encourage passengers to spread out along the platform and to use all doors. In fact, several operators excel at creatively encouraging our customers to use all those doors. And some of you may have heard that the Washington City's paper Best Metro Driver Award recently went to Mr. Lamore Rogers. So let's take a listen to understand why he won this award.
The next station is along the front plaza. Transport to the green and yellow line shows on the other level, squares on the right side. Platform, may I have your attention? Customers on the platform, please allow the customers on the train to exit first. It's common courtesy. Also, you have 18 doors to board the train. You can spread out while the train is still moving. 18. Doors. Interviewer, customers waiting to board the train, if you look around, you may see doors that no one are using. Please spread out, especially when they're on the train. For those who spread it out. The next station is Smithsonian.
That's the voice of the operator. Okay. So, looking forward, this presentation has shown the value of tracking passenger loadings by car versus by train as a key to understanding our customer experience. So Metro staff will continue to collect this very important information. We will also continue to bring the board and the quarterly vital signs reports how Metro is adhering to those 3 rail service standards. We'll continue our daily tactics of managing headways and making sure our customers know when the next train will arrive, and encouraging customers to use all doors. And finally, our longer-term strategy to obtain Metro 2025 funding to support 100% 8-car trains and necessary core station improvements. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Hinman. This presentation really does kind of highlight the root of what we work toward every day. We measure and try and calculate how best to serve our customer, and is the customer satisfied? And our measurement says, yes, we're happy. And our customers say, we're not satisfied.
Right.
And it just repeats for us, I think, the number of times we need to go down into this information that we're targeting to see if we really are meeting what the customer feels, not just what we can measure. So I think our next steps are going to be very important to get through this. Let me open the floor for discussion. I'm going to start Ms. Porter and then Mr. Bolger and Ms. Hines.
Thank you for this update. I appreciate it. I wanted to clarify on the slide that says starts zooming in closer, customers' experience on crowded cars. You said 75% of the passengers are on cars that are crowded. Is that what you said?
That is correct.
Now, are you talking about a particular train or all 3 of them?
So just if you're looking at train 5 that arrived at 512 and 515.
Okay.
So I take that example because when you look at all these bars, it's hard to get the person. So that's what I wanted to really highlight, is most of the people, 75% of those people on those two trains are in crowded cars.
Right. That led me to another question when I was looking at these numbers before. I can see that average passengers per car would be a useful metric for deciding how we allocate service and things like that. But it seems to me it's not a very useful metric for looking at how things look from a passenger perspective. Perhaps we should be looking at something in addition to passengers per car, something like the proportion of cars that are over our service standards or under our service standards, or the proportion of passengers, as you said, the proportion of passengers who are in a car that's over our crowding standards. That seems to me it would get more closely at what people are actually looking at when they're experiencing a ride on a crowded train. If people are in a car that's over 120 people per car, it doesn't make them feel any better to know that there's a car, there's a train somewhere else where there's only four people in a car. That doesn't make them feel any better at all. It doesn't offset their experience. And so I think we need to look at something beyond averages. Averages are not really very good for something like this. And as I said, for operational purposes, they may be the metric that we need. But for looking at how our customers experience the ride on the train, it's not very effective. So I think we should add to that. The other thing is just thinking about how people experience crowding. You said there are, 60-something seats on an average. And so if at 100, which we're saying is optimal, that means you've got every seat filled and 35 people standing. When you get up to 120, you've got every seat filled and almost one person standing for every seat filled, which can feel very crowded. The aisles aren't that wide that you can put two people abreast, so that really is a pretty jammed car. So thinking about this, I came up with two things. One, I think we needed something other than simply average passengers per car if we're going to measure people's experiences. And secondly, maybe the standards that we've got are not adequate for expressing crowding. Maybe people feel crowded at a lower level, at a lower number of people per car. So I would put those two out there for consideration.
I appreciate those comments, and I think we also are looking very closely at our customer complaint data and our customer satisfaction survey data to make sure that we're finding other ways to hear from our customer. But I do think relooking at this, the passenger per car, the raw data, which we've done here, I think it's very important for us to understand that customer perspective. And the final point I want to make is, I appreciate your comments. I think we need to look, keep looking closer at this.
To Ms. Porter's point, not only are we refining our customer satisfaction survey instrument to try to collect more information from our customers about their perceptions of crowding, I think the other noteworthy piece around the customer experience is the duration of your trip during which you're crowded. So, for example, if I board at Judiciary Square and ride to Shady Grove at home every night, I'm crowded until I get out of the core. But for two-thirds of my trip, I'm often sitting by myself. So the customer may experience crowding for a portion of their trip, but not all of the trip. And I think we need to understand that as well in terms of service allocation. Mr. Boulder?
Madam Chair, should we consider having either the station managers or the operators to making more announcements when trained, like we heard earlier, as a practical matter, based on the data we have for what you're showing us? I mean, for the 512, the 515, and which, if somebody was making more announcements, maybe to spread out, is that an operational consideration that we could try as a matter of operating courtesy?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, you know, being able to make the announcements, you know, as we look at the effectiveness of it, we collect this data to be able to see that, you know, from a resource issue, you know how often we can get station managers down there, because, you know, and from a resource issue, to be able to have the station managers effectively, you know, stationed, you know, in the platform, those announcements that are being made, when they're being made, where the station manager is, you know, at the period of time. Like, generally, you know, they're out of the kiosk, you know, they're out of the kiosk, but they're out of the kiosk to be able to mostly help people with ticketing vending machines, you know, being able to enter the system there, so they're unable to make announcements then. We can look at getting announcements out of the RCC, which we can do into the stations in these specific areas. So that is the type of things that we start to get these data. What we look at is the effectiveness of being able to do those types of things to be able to spread people out.
So, I would just say, Rob, if the train operator were who is running trains in those high peak crowded segments, if we told them that we want you to make these announcements regularly, because we know statistically they're probably neat, we need to spread the platform.
Right. And, that's, and again, as the operator, I mean, that's a resource that we have, obviously, that can make those announcements. And like I said, we look at the effectiveness of being able to do that and moving people out.
Well, final question. Will the new 7,000 series cars have an automatic way of articulating spread out, or will it still be the operator's responsibility?
Not based on the stations.
Yeah. Okay, so the operator is really the only one that can really make an announcement.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Let me go to Ms. Is that a follow-up for Mr. Bolger or a question? Ms.
No.
Okay. Ms. Hind and then Ms. Damsons.
This is really very, very interesting, and I really want to thank you all for putting it together so we can see. I mean, it's interesting when you look at the 512. Across those six cars, we're below the 100 if you average it across the six cars. So there really is an issue here, I think, about how do we help our customers understand that they can be more comfortable and help them make reasonable choices about where they get on the train and how that intersects with where they want to get off the train. So there are a couple of things that I think we could at least think about to give our customers a little bit more control and more information about how to be more comfortable. One of them is to mark where the end of the six-car train is so that people have a better sense of what spreading out in for a six-car train actually means. It's particularly when you first go into a station, it's really hard to sort of figure out where that is. And so there are all of us who do our regular pattern, and we eventually figure it out. But there's an awful lot of people who go a new place or who, for whom this is the first time, and we're not giving them a lot of cues that would help. Which brings me to another thing. So I, like everybody, I know where to get on at my home station. I know where to get off at the stations that I go to regularly. If I'm going to someplace I've never been before, there is nowhere for me on the website to try to figure out where I should be, where I should get on my train, my familiar train, in order to get off and be efficient at the station that I'm going to. And we might want to think about whether there's a way to help our regular riders plan for a new trip and how to position themselves in the train. And the last idea I have is, you know, our riders are so creative. And if we were to say to them, hey, we have this new data, what we're seeing is we're not using what we have out there very efficiently. Do you have ideas to help us figure out how to use our resources more? Our writers have come up with other really great suggestions. And so I think we ought to have a summertime contest of help us use our trains better and invite the public to give us their good ideas. Because I bet they'll come up with some things we haven't thought of that are simple to implement that could really help make everybody's ride more comfortable. So. But thanks again for gathering all the data.
Okay. Mr. Davis, did you have a question?
If you could put the full chart up that this is part of. There's an interesting lesson between 521 and 526 is a five-minute gap. The ones that you were looking at are all 3 minutes. Then there is another five-minute gap. Mm-hmm. Then there's another five-minute gap. Then there's a two-minute gap. then there's a six-minute gap. The sensitivity about loading comes from schedule adherence and whether or not at rush hour we can actually maintain schedule. When I get into the station and I look and see at rush hour that the next train is in 6 minutes versus three, I know that I'm going to have a hard time getting on the train no matter where I stand on the platform. The reason I mention this is my sense is after the Silver Line opens, this is scheduled maintenance at rush hour, particularly on the Blue Line, about perceptions of crowding is going to be even more critical. And if there is a lesson on this chart, it's that we are very schedule sensitive about crowding, and I don't know how you manage that better or how we communicate better reasons for changes in schedule. But if we're going to tackle dissatisfaction, part of it has to do with schedule adherence. The other is that this morning there was a minor meltdown on the Red Line as a train had to offload at DuPont Circle. And the perception of everybody on the train was, this is a sardine can. And there were people, we left lots and lots of people on the platform. People couldn't get off and on at Farragut. They had trouble getting off and on at Metro Center. This thing just kind of, and that's a perception that stays with the writer, whether there was an offloaded train or not, about their perceptions about crowding. Better communications about stuff that had happening on the railroad. The train operator did say, offloaded train, DuPont Circle, that was it. That didn't help with all the people coming on board or trying to get off down the road. Communication about incidents can probably help customers better understand what's happening, and we ought to take advantage of that intercom and training about announcements about service interruptions.
Thank you. And what I will say is that, you know, one thing that Hercules Ballard has done, he's our director of rail operations, is to try to start to script out for incidences, you know, like the top five incidents, things like trains offloads, single tracking events, to be able to script them out for the train operators so that that message is being consistently put to the passengers, you know, in a way that they can begin to understand rather than just sort of leaving it up to the train operator to make determinations. So he's been working closely with the customer care people to develop those scripts that we can put them out.
Okay. Let me go to Mr. Dyke. I think I have the right list down here. Mr. Dyke and then Mr. Downey. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I say some things that probably have been said before, but this is very useful in terms of thinking. Purpose of having standards is to see what we can do to make things better for the customer. And there's some things we have control over. There's some we don't really. I mean, we're running as many trains as we can in this hour. We should have better schedule adherence because, as Mr. Downs points out, that does affect crowding. And we make the trains more or less as long as we can. We'll get some more cars, we're going to make them longer. But I think there is the opportunity to educate our customers in terms of the choices they can make. Look at this chart, and it says the ends of the train are likely to have fewer people than the front. If you know that and you would prefer less crowding as opposed to preferring being in the exact right place to get off, you make that choice. I'm always amazed at McPherson. If you look at the display and discover that a train will be coming in that's an eight-car train and walk to the back of that, which is behind the escalators, always get a seat. Nobody does it. I do it, but virtually no one else. I think if we tell the customers, and as Mary said, how do we get the word out, the choices that you can make, then there's also additional information. The operator who will say, I think it's very helpful, yes, this train is very crowded, and the next one is coming in a minute, lots of people will step back and say, I'll wait that minute, or they may look up at the display and say, not quite sure that's what's happening. But more ways to educate that choices the customer makes can affect the comfort of their ride would be helpful.
Thank you. Mr. Yeah. Dyke, and then
no, just a brief repeat of, I think, one of the points that Tom made was the idea of training for the operators so that they at least use that intercom to tell you, for example, if you're stalled between stations for a few minutes, just to come on and say that, you know, there's a train ahead of us that is stopped and we may be here a few minutes, or at least people know, as opposed to experiences that I've had where you hear nothing. And that's what really, I think, gets customers riled up, is you have no idea what's going on and you get a lot of grumbling, whereas just one brief comment to say that, you know, a train is stopped, we're going to be here a few minutes, at least people can adjust to that. And I know we'll probably be discussing training of other officials later on in the discussion today, but I think we really do need to focus in on that and to make sure that the people who are in those positions are the right people to do the things that we're talking about.
Well, I was about to say we're setting Ms. Bowersock up for her presentation, but is there just a few more comments, and then we'll go to that next presentation. Ms. Porter and Mr. Yule, and then we'll go to the next presentation.
So state that again.
So when we're looking at the normal use case schedule appearance standards, you mean across the entire day?
For if we're talking about crowding, the crowding, so for headways, it is for the whole day, but there are various standards that will apply based on the time of day. Okay. True, and I think in the vital signs report, that is when we come to the board and talk about how well we are delivering the scheduled service. So that's our on-time performance. So for the standards, it's where we're looking to make sure that we're scheduling service according to these standards. So that's kind of a nuance, but it's important.
Right. That's essentially the point I was making.
Okay.
This is not that the schedule, that the actual number of trains or the actual arrival of trains adheres to the standard.
Correct.
It's that our schedule adheres to the
correct
standard.
Correct, and that's a very important clarification.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Yule.
Thank you. Thank you. This has been a very healthy discussion, and everything that I was going to say has already been said. I think it really, again, boils down to communication and a lot more, particularly from the station managers, because my experience is that there's lack of communication from them in terms of help, being able to help the passengers. And I think the other, you know, factor here that we haven't discussed is, you know, we have a large tourist population that uses the system. And my observation is that when people come up, tourists come up off the platform, I mean, up the escalator or the stairs, elevator, whatever, they just stand in the middle, and their comfort level is with the daily ridership. And they can board a train with them, and the daily riders know which cars to get on. And then once they're in the car, then they can say, oh, where can I get off? What's the best stop? And so, again, maybe through some education or more signage, you know, better signage, we can help aid the tourists. But there's sometimes when I get to arrive to a station, I see people, they come up the escalator with me, and then they just scatter all the way down. And I say, gosh, why are they going all the way down there when they can stand right here in the middle? I'm the one that wants to be, because as you've already described, you know where to get off. You know when you get off, you get on a particular car, you get off at a station, the escalator is going to be there. You just go right down the whole bit. So it really gets down to a lot of just trying to get more, better, enhanced communication, better education, but getting input from the riders as well.
Thank you, Mr. Yule. And I'm going to now turn to Ms. Bowersock. And thank you very much, Dr. Henry,
sure,
because I think...
Last thing I want to say is I think I just very much appreciate the conversation. I think it really highlights the partnership that crowding is, which is between the communications, our ability to operate, capital investments, and really our passengers. So I think this conversation really highlighted that very important partnership that we're striving towards. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We look forward to your return to us. Ms. Bowersock, I think we've had a great deal of discussion about the customer and the interest that the board has in the customer service meeting its expectations, and I think this new initiative is a very good presentation. It's a good follow-up of our prior.
Thank you. It is a good segue to what we want to talk about today, and I know that one of the board's most important strategic goals, first among equals perhaps, is our goal to meet and exceed our customers' expectations. And we've been working very hard this year to try to put together a program to move forward on that goal. And I'd like to start by acknowledging and recognizing the customer care working group that's been formed. If you would all stand, please, everybody in the room who's part of the customer care working group. This group is an interdepartmental task force of managers who represent bus, rail, police, HR, IT, Metro Access, customer service and communications, and I'm leaving others out. But I asked them to stand today because I want you to see the cross-section team that we've brought together. It represents an enterprise-wide effort to put our customers at the front of our decision-making. Thank you all. And I also want you to know that this group represents not only people with 25 years' experience at WMATA, and it does, but also people who have 1 year at WMATA and came from other transit properties and brought with them lessons learned and best practices from Boston and Baltimore and Chicago and other places. So I think we have a first-class team assembled to help us move forward on this, and I've been very proud of the work that they've done for the past few months, and that's the work that I'm representing today. So with that in mind, the board will recall that the Riders Advisory Council advanced a customer value statement last year, and the board adopted and approved both a long and a short version of that customer value statement, and this is just the short version that I present as a reminder. When we think about our mission on customer care excellence, we think about the board's strategic goal, we think in fact about how to implement this customer value statement as an institutional value, and we also think about the general manager's business plan because our day-to-day work, our budgeting, and so forth is in support of that business plan, which helps us achieve those other objectives. And so we've aligned our program to support all of those needs. When we look at where we are today, I think the most important statement we need to make as an institution is that we are, at the board level, investing in customer service. We know how important the safety investments have been. Our customers take safety as a given, but they think in terms of customer satisfaction that job one after safety is reliability. Service reliability is the single most important factor in customer satisfaction. And the investments we've made in infrastructure and equipment and in improving things at WMATA stations, et cetera, is central to our ability to deliver reliable service for our customers. So that continued investment and the discussion today about rail cars is a really great example. When customers board these cars, they expect to make the entire trip on that same train, and offload is all too common. In fact, 6 of 10 delays to our customers is caused by a train issue, not a track issue or station issue, but a train issue. Most of those, because that number ranges from a mechanical issue to a customer holding doors, okay? So it's a wide range in that number. But most of those issues get addressed when you have a 7K fleet and you're no longer operating a mixed consist fleet with 30-year-old equipment. at least some of those issues get addressed and the reliability will go up. So the investments today in the 7Ks that are coming, as well as those the board has planned through the Momentum program, are essential to customer service because they go straight to the issue of reliability. Also, the bus fleet replacement and rehabilitation program, which is keeping our fleet at a 7.5-year average age, very critical to our bus customers, both in terms of their perception of cleanliness, which is very important to our bus customers, as well as service reliability. That reliability is getting better. In 2013, Metro Rail on-time performance reached 92%, which was a full percentage point better than 2012, and the best annual on-time performance in the last 5 years. Metro Bus has also seen long-term improvements despite traffic congestion. Bus on-time performance is up 4.5% since 2010. And the good news I have for you today, which is relevant to the last discussion, is that when we make a concerted effort to improve something for our customers, we see in our customer satisfaction results coming back, their recognition of that. And the focus that we've placed on announcements is starting to bear fruit. Hercules Ballard, who's with me today, the Director of Rail Operations, has really had a very focused effort on the frequency and clarity of announcements on board. And we've gone in the last year from about a 40% customer satisfaction rate with onboard announcements to more than 70% in the last quarter, about a 30% jump. That's very significant, and it shows the benefit of his effort. Recognize and thank him for that. Obviously, we still have a way to go. And I was thinking as you all were talking about the phone call I took just a month ago from a stakeholder and a customer who's a fan of Metro who called to say, thank you for everything you're doing to make announcements more clear. Now, could you tell them to make them less frequently because I can't bear to hear every 2 minutes we're waiting for a signal to proceed. We're sorry for the inconvenience. It's driving me crazy. So there's this balance, right, between the visitors who need to know every 2 minutes so they're reassured what's going on and those day-to-day commuters who sort of get it and they know what they need to know and the frequency can be overmatch. So Hercules is a great leader, and I'm sure he will find a way to help everybody figure out how to nuance and strike that balance. It is a challenge every single day on every single train, but we are getting there. So what, given everything that we've accomplished, can we do to move us forward? We started with a SWOT analysis, and I compliment Barbara Moulton, who is chairing this working group, who came to us from the MBTA, who helped us through this. We basically went back and looked. You'll remember in 2012 we did an employee engagement survey. We all believe that engaged employees are absolutely essential to the customer experience. If our employees aren't committed, aren't engaged, aren't equipped, they're not going to be able to deliver that service for our customers. Going back to the engagement survey allowed us to ferret out information about where the employees were with respect to communications and other things that make a difference in their lives. We also did focus groups with our employees, in particular our station managers. Candidly, we talked to those who are stellar in delivering customer service and frequently get commendations. We also talked to those who are more challenged to find out what the barriers are to delivering good customer service every day, what tools, what information folks need, and what more we could do to better equip them. We looked at a lot of the process, policies, and protocols that the authority has in place, and you may be surprised to learn that over the 30-plus years of development of this institution, we have not had a lot of consistency or an updating around job descriptions. So when you think about the way that we talk to our employees from the day they're hired, and then we try to hold ourselves accountable for certain things, how we communicate what their duties are is really essential up front, what the expectations are. And it also speaks to how we recruit and who we're recruiting and for what skill set. And as you'll hear from Tanya Moore McGee, the undertaking that she is leading around job descriptions, job classifications within family of jobs, job skill identification is going to be an authority-wide process that's really going to serve well our customer service needs. We need job descriptions that say to people, here's what our expectations are around customer service. We have to articulate that clearly it then becomes very important that in our performance evaluations from our frontline right up into our ELT, that we have a mandatory assessment of how people are performing with respect to customer service, just as we do today with respect to safety. And it's important that we then are able to hold ourselves accountable and that we have measures of how we are performing in customer service. Those don't exist consistently across the authority today, and we need to put those in place. We're also missing some key information tools, information that will allow us to see things as the customers experience them. You pointed this out with the passengers per car, great industry standard, but is it really meaningful in terms of the customer experience, as well as our feedback loop to employees? Very often, you know, station managers, I think, have, apart from bus operators, the hardest job in Metro because they get all of the input from customers about things that aren't going well. They turn around and they feed us all of that input, but we're not always great about giving back to them information about what it is that we're doing to respond to their needs. If they don't feel empowered with that information, they're not able then to repeat it back to customers, and we miss an opportunity. And that's happening today, and we're going to address that. So how does all this come together? Well, in the next slide, you see some of the key highlights, but let me just point to three areas of focus. Obviously, the first around training is critical. We have a new employee orientation today that is great. It's come a long way. It focuses on safety. As the newer people in the customer care working group will tell you, they walk away from that NEO training thinking that this is an organization with a very strong safety culture. What we need to do is to inject customer service into that new employee orientation training, because they don't walk away today with a sense that they're serving customers. It's still very transportation oriented. We're still a transportation company. We're still moving equipment, okay? And we need to really change the way we do training. Another one of Tanya's initiatives is a new first line supervisor training. We're starting to call it Metro University. When you think about going from being a new employee to maybe moving through the ranks into frontline supervisor to what your professional development track is to becoming a senior manager, we think about all the tools and skills you need, all the legal information, all of the management of people information, all of the how to budget information. Well, when we're giving you that, which we don't today, but as we plan to do that moving forward, key in that will be expectations around customer service. And so Tanya's going to be integrating that first into the new supervisor training. We also, I talked about business intelligence tools. IT is with us on this working group. And let me try to see if I can do this justice. The new BI tools that we help us integrate data and aggregate it in ways that give us a different opportunity to snapshot it in more useful ways for people. So today, if within Rob's organization, he's getting reports, station managers are calling and saying the HVAC is out in my station, the escalator is not functioning in the station, we have a cleanliness issue, we have trash overflowing in the station, or let's see, trying to think of another one, but you get the message. All of those things are stovepiped into channels that deliver that information into the right places in this organization to affect repairs or rehabilitation or to be addressed. But nowhere is there a crosscut of those reports that looks at it on a station-by-station basis so that Hercules or Rob would have a picture that says, here at Metro Center, you have four major systems that are all having issues at the same time. So from the customer's perspective, Metro Center is not doing well. We need those kind of tools, and we need to have those tools available not only for managers in order to prioritize their resources and to address things at the customer level, but also for station managers to have a feedback loop so they know when they're reporting all of that, what the status of those repairs are, and how fast they should expect to get some relief for their customers. That's going to be key in having them be good ambassadors for us. And then the third item I want to mention, and we borrowed this from the success of the safety committees, is to have local committees so that employees at every level can become involved in not only addressing what the issues are, but helping us to find solutions. And so on a station-by-station, on a zone-by-zone basis, we're going to be having some local customer service committees to try to begin to encourage two-way dialogue about how to move these things forward. So it won't just be management, but also employees at the same time. And if you look here at Exhibit A, if we can call up Exhibit A, it sort of gives you that slice of what a station manager might be experiencing. We have Exhibit A on the slide? No? Keep going. One more. That's it. So I'm not sure if you can see this in the back, but we have escalators. We have the station manager having the face-to-face. Fare equipment, that's one of the things that I miss, which is often a source of challenge for folks. The HVAC, the cleaning, so all of these things are coming together. And in Rob's organization, they're hearing about these issues. But at the station level, we don't see the whole picture. So those are one of the areas that we want to try to rectify. If you go to the, if we go back, if you would, to the customer care rocket for success. This is a very busy slide, as you will see it, because it tries to capture all of the different areas that we're going to be focusing on. So let me highlight just the last two on the right. When it comes to the station teaming concept for rail, Rob and Hercules have been working on a program to advance how our station managers interact with our customers. It's everything from relooking at the job responsibilities, rewriting the job description, retitling the job. We're not sure people are there to manage the stations. Maybe they're there to serve the customers. So maybe the misnomer on the title is something to look at. And they're also looking at the uniforms. It was Rob who said to me, I'm not sure that the neon vest is setting them apart from the track workers. And people don't really feel that they're accessible, that they're maybe even the right person to ask. So maybe we ought to dress the part of a customer service person. It sounds so obvious when you hear that out loud, but for 35 years, I think we've had them in neon vests. So I appreciate the leadership there, and that's something that Hercules' group is looking at, and Rob's brought employees into that to talk about how do they dress, how does it make them feel, how does it portray to the customer. And they're designing a new look and feel for their uniforms so it's more public-facing and less internal. With respect to bus management, Bob Potts is here with me today. Bob is engineering a new program for how we manage the bus operations on the street. Bob's put more of his supervisors in the street. He's gotten them out of cars. He's got them at bus stops. He's got them interacting with bus operators, trying to troubleshoot problems locally before they escalate, trying to manage buses so that we can avoid bus bunching and the other things that cause crowding and problems for our bus customers. And he can answer any questions you may have about that. But it's also a very good program and an innovation, and it's very, very customer-centric. In the next slide, you'll see that we're going to organize ourselves into subcommittees, into smaller working groups. We have groups on rider experience and performance metrics and business intelligence tools. We have one on training and development. We have one on employee performance review because we really believe that accountability is going to be critical in this exercise, and one on internal communications because this, like safety, will take a very proactive effort across a long period of time to change the culture here about how we view customers and to articulate that. So that will be a top-down exercise, not only from Mr. Sarles, the general manager, but from the entire executive leadership team. And we have a lot of support and enthusiasm about doing that over the next year to begin. We are going to be with the Riders Advisory Council and the Access Group in September to share this with them and to get their input and ideas and suggestions. And as the chair has requested that we come back, we're proposing in January, and then as frequently as you would like updates to let you know how we're doing. But we are prepared to take any questions you may have.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And we're running a little bit late, but I think it's important that we have a good, healthy discussion about this. I'll start with Mr. Dyke and then Mr. Bolger.
I just want to focus less when you describe this job descriptions and all those things. For me, I think that's critical to describe what it is you want these people to do and what their responsibilities are. But part of that discussion also has to be a bigger problem, a bigger issue of do we have the right people in the right jobs, and how do you qualify to become a station manager? Are we recruiting people because they can be good station managers, or are we recruiting them because they've been here a period. And I realize that's a sensitive subject, but if you're talking about this from a management perspective, we need to step up and have a job description and have people have the skills to meet that those requirements. And I think we need to begin that process. We need to start it as quickly as we can. I think we need to emphasize the whole customer care issue. You talked about Metro University. If we want to use to go to somebody who's got some background, the folks at Disney have done a tremendous job on focusing on customer satisfaction and taking care of your clients, your customers, the people that you're there to serve. And we would do well to basically reach out to them. And if there's some things we can pick up to use here, I would strongly urge us to do that. But I'm prepared to focus on that issue, but I'm prepared to also focus on the bigger issue. And I think we need to get it out on the table.
To answer your question as to how persons become a station manager, based on the labor contract, most of our station managers were former bus operators. So any bus operator or any train operator who, based on their seniority, and they have the physical, you know, abilities to perform the job, then they, by contract, then we must elect them to become station managers.
Now, you put your finger right on the issue that I was trying to address.
Well, I think Tommy can speak to this, too. I mean, there's a couple of steps. Number one, we want bus operators to be as customer-friendly as station managers are. They encounter every customer on a one-on-one basis on their bus every day. So it starts with the pool of talent that you recruit for bus operators. And so we need to focus on what skills are necessary to become a bus operator, and it's not just your ability to get a CDL. Operating a bus is important, and doing that safely is key. But if you don't know how to interact with your customer, you probably shouldn't be qualified. So that's number one, and that's something that, that Tanya can speak to in terms of what her effort's going to be looking at. The second issue is about looking at, you know, how we do select station managers. And I think that labor relations is represented in our customer care group, and we are going to be talking about that selection process going forward.
I'd just like to add something to that, if I could. You know, as Herc said, you know, we do have, you know, we do pull people out of the bus operators' ranks. And I think what is most important here is to understand, first of all, that, you know, we have a requirement to be able to define what these people need to do. We have a requirement to be able to manage against those expectations. You know, the labor agreement does not provide them an opportunity not to do the work that's necessary of them, but we define what it is. And, again, a lot of that is updating the job description. I think what's also very important is to understand, I mean, you brought up Disney World, and one of the things was, you know, I'd actually been down at Disney World in a prior job that I had to study how they do things. Their parking lot attendants get 2 weeks of training to park cars. Their parking lot attendants get 2 weeks of training to do that. That's one of the things that we are beginning to focus on, is to say we need to give our people the tools to be able to understand how to deal with the public, which they don't always have. You know, the same thing that we do with an ATC mechanic to give them the meters and everything else we do, we need to be able to give them the tools. And those tools that we give them is through the training elements that we have, so that they understand how to deal with a customer that has been, you know, on a train for half an hour, gets out of the station, and his car doesn't work, how to be able to deal with them, and that sometimes maybe have to walk away from that customer when it escalates, to know how to do those things, to know how to talk to that customer in a way that is not confrontational, that can draw that customer down from those things. So I think what's very, very important here is that when we look at this, first we need to absolutely look at our training and to be able to get that well established, to be able to give them the tools for that. So.
The ANF meeting this afternoon about the initiatives that we will be engaging in to address a number of the issues that Len raised.
Yes, sir. Like Mr. Troop said, we are not tied, you know, just to the type of individual that we hire into the position as station manager. What we looked at is we looked at this as we're moving from an organization that was focused primarily on moving customers to an organization that's more customer service oriented. And going back to an organization that is moving, having a paradigm shift. It's not easy getting people on board, getting people to realize that this is a new initiative, this is something that's important, and this is where we direction that we must all go. So what we look at is a holistic approach, because we know it's not just individuals that that cause this problem or individuals that will correct this problem. We have a workforce of over 500 station managers. And out of that 500 station managers, I'm very pleased to say most of those station managers perform extraordinarily every single day. It's just a very few individuals within that group that get involved in these reprehensible acts. And we address those as they become known to us. Looking at, you know, station managers, when I first moved in this position, I got a report on customer complaints. And I was sitting in my office and I read the report. And what the report said was that the customer went to the station manager, had a bad experience, and she wanted to know the station manager's name. The station manager was readily willing to give his name because the station manager said to the customer, they're not going to do anything to me. And that struck me, you know, to the core, because how could a station manager, how could any employee be so comfortable, you know, letting their managers know that they weren't performing their job? So I tried to figure out what was the reason for, you know, that kind of behavior. I figured they probably weren't properly trained. There was a lack of accountability, a lack of supervision. And some folks probably just weren't suited for the position as station managers. So we looked at the training, like Mr. True said. We found out that we said we were concerned about customer service, delivering stellar customer service, but we were giving station managers 1 hour training out of a 8-week program. So from that, we knew that it just was not enough. So we went and we found a vendor and had a customer service training module created for us. And we sent all of our station managers, all of our supervisors, all of our managers, to include myself, through the training. For me, that was just the first level, first phase training, because getting folks to understand how to deliver quality customer service can't be taught in one day, can't be taught in one session. It has to be an ongoing training effort. So we always knew we had to move to phase two, and we were going to phase two at this point. We've put an RFP to bring in a vendor to give our station managers more what I call situational type customer service training, how to deal with customers, like Mr. Truth said, when they have these situations, the customer has a complaint, how to manage that property. So it'll be more role playing for the station managers. And after we go through phase number two, then we go through phase number three, phase number four, and ongoing training for station managers. And I think that's how we'll get station managers to know how to deliver the quality service that we're asking them to train. Some people can do this naturally. Some people have to be trained to provide what we're asking them for. And as far as accountability, we make sure that our supervisors, we have 100 supervisors, we make sure that those supervisors are out there monitoring these station managers. We're even working with BUS, where we have BUS supervisors who are out of uniform, who go into the system as customers, you know, engage the station managers and see how the station managers perform. And we try to focus on station managers who have been involved in multiple complaints. We have what we call a performance improvement program. And what we do, any station manager that has had 3 complaints within a 6-month period, that station manager is brought in to see their division superintendent. They're brought in to see their station superintendent. They're brought in to see their director of train operation, and finally come in and see me. We have a discussion, you know, find out what the issues are. Why are they involved in those kinds of situations, and why they don't know how to perform properly when faced with those situations. So the program has been relatively successful. Mr. Troop wants to add another element to that. So what we're going to do is we're working with procurement to bring in a vendor to also, after the station managers meet with me, then they'll meet with that vendor to get additional coaching. And there's 2-4 reasons for this performance improvement program. First one is to try to mentor, coach, and modify the behavior of the station managers. The second one is to document that we've done everything that we needed to do to modify that station manager performance, where if we get to the point we have to take disciplinary actions against that employee, we can demonstrate that we made the effort to first, you know, get the employee to perform as they were trained to perform. The other situation, the lack of supervision. What I found is that a lot of our supervisors were hired as bus operators and came into the ranks with the station managers. So some of them were not always objective, could separate themselves when it came to discipline, taking necessary actions against the station manager who were performing appropriately. So what we did was we revised the supervisor's job description. Also, we did the station manager's, but we revised the supervisor's job description because what we have is we have individuals who technically sound as station managers and train operators, and we roll them into supervisor positions. But what we need are individuals who are sound supervisors. So what we did was we took out the transportation requirement in a supervisor job description. So now what we get are people who are experienced supervisors. And at first, you know, the managers weren't open to that, you know, new approach. So we hired a few supervisors who did not have transportation experience. It was pretty successful. So the supervisors now, they're more open to that. About 2 months ago, we had a hiring event, and 50% of the supervisors who were hired promoted into the supervisor's position were non-Metro employees and individuals who have no prior supervisor experience. The quality, just to let you know the quality of individuals that we're bringing in, one of the individuals is a military Air Force sergeant at Andrews. He is the supervisor for the ground crew of Air Force One, and he'll be on board at the end of this month. So by opening up the pool of individuals who are eligible to come to become supervisors, it allows us to get a, not necessarily a better, but a more experienced workforce in here to supervise our workforce. What we've also done is we've gone and we looked at the managers and we said, you know, maybe the managers need some additional training also. So what we've done is all of the rail transportation managers now have an executive coach to include me. So, you know, on a regular basis, you meet with our coach and our coach tells us what we're doing well and what we need to improve on. So, so along with the supervisor getting, you know, additional training, we also get a training for ourselves. And when you talk about looking at individuals and see if they're suited for the position, not station managers, like I said, majority of station managers do a great job. During the snowstorm, during the last winter, there was never a day that the stations, that any station was not open because station managers are committed. You know, they come to work, you know, they have to get up 3 o'clock in the morning, they have to dig their car out and drive and be in the station at 5 o'clock every day. More than 100, you know, 15 station managers were on the property to open the stations up at 5 a.m. So they do a great job in a lot of respects. So I don't want, you know, the board to think that, you know, we have a cadre of individuals who aren't committed, who don't perform, who aren't, don't care about the organization, and a lot of them do. It's just like the old adage said, that 10% of the workforce create 90% of the problem, and that's kind of where we are here today, right? And so we want to really focus on that 90%.
Thank you, Mr. Bell. Thank you very much. Okay. We have a couple of time.
I'll be really short.
Time for questions. Mr. Belger and Mr.
All right. Bell. I mentioned this to our general manager the other day. So after our call the other day, Madam Chairman, I went and talked to our station manager at Farragut, and he gets out of his kiosk, and he looks like a track worker. So, and Rich said we're going to dress him up. Okay, so and my idea was to have some kind of a tire that people know that the station manager is not a track worker. So I'm glad to hear that that's working. And because I talk to station managers all the time because they're in their kiosks. They say, come on out, but we want you out. We want you out front. But the vest's got to go. Jim pointed out the Disney thing. I borrowed something from my wife's company, which is in the hotel industry. And they have a thing called Bravo Awards that you may, I'll give you this little email, where colleagues and customers can recognize, you know, good customer service in the hotel industry, which is the hospitality industry, really. And we may want to consider that. Rich says we have something like that. I didn't know we did, but it, and then
kudos to you.
It's called what?
Kudos to you.
I didn't know that. Okay, so I'll share this thing from the hotel industry with you all.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Brown?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Ms. Bowersox, I just had a question about how performance would be measured or how you're going to measure the impact of this really important initiative. I appreciate what you said about the customer service announcements and that you had been able to measure improvement there. Are there specific measures that have been laid out for the customer service initiative, or are there existing vital signs, or how will that be done?
Sure. So with respect to performance evaluations, we have one set of performance evaluations for managers that was redesigned in the last year that's going through some final tweaking. And in the tweaking, what we've learned is that we need to have a standard that says, you know, basically, here's a customer service metric that's applicable to you in your area. That could be external facing, it could be internal facing customers, but that there needs to be something in every single person's evaluation that measures that and that speaks to specific goals and objectives associated with their particular role and responsibility. So it won't be a one-size-fits-all metric. It'll be something that's specific to your job, but everybody has to have it, just as we all have safety goals today and safety measures that were evaluated based on. In the front lines, it's a little bit different. Maybe the best example today is in bus maintenance, where every single employee is evaluated. And so, irrespective of whether they're represented or non-represented, and Phil Wallace does a great job, and so we're going to look at that model and see where else it applies. The supervisor who has a couple of hundred employees needs a way to evaluate them every year in a short form way that really gets to a very direct conversation about the standards of performance. And one of the things that we heard back from employees when we talked to them is, I really only hear from my boss if there's something wrong. I don't often hear if there's something right unless I get a commendation. So one of the things that we're trying to do with this is create a conversation between supervisors and employees that says, here's what you're doing well, as much as there's an issue. The performance evaluation is meant to create those conversations, to create that dialogue, and requiring it on an annual basis hopefully will further that goal. And I don't know, Tanya, if I represented that well, if you want to add anything. Okay. Did that answer your question?
Richard.
Okay. Yes, Mr. Troop told us that we need to change the station manager's uniform. Mr. Troop told us we need to change the station manager's uniform. It was absolutely a great idea because when I go into the system, it's very difficult for me sometimes to discern who's a station manager and who's not. A lot of the Metro employees have a very similar uniform. So what I do when I go into the station is I have to look at the patch that's on the sleeve of the employee to determine who is the station manager, who's not. And so if it's difficult for me to do that, you know how difficult it is for a customer to be able to tell who is the station manager, who isn't. So what we've done based on Mr. Troop's instruction is that we brought in station managers and had them be a part of a focus group to decide how the new uniform would look. I think it's an absolutely great uniform change. It's the shirt is yellow, so it's pretty distinctive. So when you go into the station, once the uniform change has been made, then you'll be more easily able to tell who a station manager is and who is not a station manager. So, and the station managers are very excited about the change. They feel very proud of the uniform and the way the uniform looks.
And it's very prominently displayed on the uniform that they are the station manager, besides the color. And no more vest, except if they have to go down to the track area.
Right. Okay. Mr. Downs, and I think we're going to try and close this meeting by 5 more minutes. I think, no, we have another.
I'll be very, very brief. First, I take the bus at least twice a day, and I have to say that bus operator customer focus has changed between night and day. I mean, there's 100% improvement, I think, in almost every bus operator that I've come across. It's not unusual for them to say good morning, have a nice day, please step to the back of the bus. It's all of that stuff in a very courteous way. Whatever has happened about changing the customer-facing attitudes of bus operating personnel deserves a lot of kudos. Second, the thing that struck me on the SWOT analysis is that under weaknesses, under employee engagement, more than 40% of frontline employees express concerns about supervisor leadership, communications, and recognition. We're not the only agency that lives with this gray area between represented and unrepresented managers, that there are very good training programs that help supervisors and employees deal with this interface between a represented semi-supervisor and represented employees and a non-represented supervisor, and to encourage everybody to not reinvent the wheel about the training processes, about what works and doesn't work in this environment where we have all of these shades of gray. The last is a suggestion that we have root cause analysis about safety issues. Root cause analysis about lessons learned from unsuccessful interactions with customers as a learning tool, as a way of improving training, is a tool that we should be pursuing, not and pursuing separately from the disciplinary process. It is more than possible to separate the two tracks about what happened and what are the lessons learned versus what happened in the disciplinary process. And I would encourage you to think more about each one of these interactions is a learning opportunity for supervisors and trainers and station managers in this kind of complex environment between customers and Metro employees. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the presentation. I think it's very important for us. I guess the overemphasizing point is that everybody in the organization plays a role in customer service. It's just what role they have in terms of that, where that is shown. And so this is a very good initiative for us, and I think it really is a responsive way to address the concerns that we've had from the board as well as our customers regarding customer service. So we look forward to you coming back to us, and I think it'll be the give you several months to get through some of your work and come back and keep us tracked and how we get to the end of it. With that, we're going to adjourn the customer services and operation. Yes? Yes.
Mm-hmm. I've suggested once or twice that the committee get a review of the pedestrian and bike access study that was done several years ago now, just an update on the action steps and how far we've come about that, and would suggest bringing it to the committee at a time and at a time where it makes sense.
We have a item in October, and if it's not included in the presented agenda here, we'll see how we can come back, because it is data that we already have. Right. Thank you very much. With that, we are adjourned.
I don't know why we have a hard time getting a focus. We did all of this great.